Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and tonight I'm proud to bring you Mythic Gaming. Zach McAtee and I will be continuing our conversation on dungeon mastering and campaign building. Greetings and welcome, Zach. How are you?
I'm doing well. Yourself?
I'm doing great, and I'm sorry Tim's not feeling well. I hope he feels better very soon.
Yeah.
So anything new and exciting on your end?
We just moved into a larger apartment this past weekend. So
congratulations.
We're still settling in. Thank you. It's a mess right now. Like no mincing words. But you know, we have everything moved over. We received some furniture and stuff we need to build yesterday. So the next couple weeks after work and stuff, we're just going to be slowly chipping away at it and getting it presentable.
Exciting adventures. That sounds really wonderful. Is there more room?
So this is a two-bedroom as opposed to our last one was a one-bedroom.
Uh-huh.
It's also got a large living room, and then our old one had a very outdated kitchen and bathroom that hadn't really been renovated in a long time. These ones were done, renovated like last year or something, so they're all brand new.
Oh, wow.
And then there's a second bedroom, which we're turning into like a game room, game space kind of thing.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Mazel tov, as some of my friends would say.
Thank you.
And as Greeks would say, yachara, health and happiness. Well, I'm really interested to exploring today's topic. I know with me, once I discovered how versatile NPCs were in running a campaign, I started having a lot of fun with the NPCs, and the players started having a lot of fun with the NPCs. The earliest, unfortunately, it wasn't Dungeons & Dragons that brought me that understanding. It was the Thieves' World set. Thieves'
okay.
World was an anthology series from way, way back in time that had like a setting that people could take different heroes into. So it had very clearly defined personalities in different places. When the setting came out, I was able to add my own personalities to it. And that's how I first discovered the wonder of NPCs. And now, sometimes you never know which NPC is going to take off. But now I have several NPCs in games
yep.
that are running that the kids loved the character. So how did you first discover the wondrous uses of NPCs?
So the first game that I ever ran was a module in the Pokemon system that I run now. And in that one, I didn't really have NPCs that were more than just kind of obstacles or waypoints, because it was just a
uh-huh.
one session module.
Right.
And so then after that, when everybody liked it, I was like, okay, well, let's do a campaign. You know, let's, you know, make something bigger out of this. And during that process, like obviously if you're doing a world, if you're doing a campaign, you need to have NPCs. And so it started with just, I like to approach it. I make a character using the system's rules, and then usually I'll take that character and make them like my first NPC in the world and make them like a bigger NPC in some way, and that way I both can walk them through how to make characters better, but also can understand from their perspective, I guess is a good way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I try to approach a lot of my more important NPCs from that perspective, from that, well, if this was a player character, what would they do, like that kind of thing.
Where did you find the personalities for the characters? I remember when I first started with Thieves World and with later on with Star Trek, there was a show, I don't know if it's still on, called Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
And they had a lot of characters on Saturday Night Live. And also there was a comedy show called Kids in the Hall, which came later, but it came during the Saturday Night Live period. So I was just taking characters that were on these shows and appropriating them and changing them a little and making them NPCs in the campaign. So if people had watched these comedy shows, they'd have an in. But a lot of people didn't watch comedy shows back then, so it was a lot of fun to play the characters.
Yeah, I think, didn't you tell me that you had John Belushi's Deli Samurai as an NPC at one point?
Yeah, I had something based on him. I had the Wild and Crazy Guys. I had Rosanna Dana. There was like a grumpy character. I had the grumpy character. And we had John Lovett, who was supposedly married to Morgan Fairchild. He was married to Morgana Le Fay. So we had all these personalities, and we put them in the NPCs. And even with wrestling, like Classy Freddy Blast, he wound up to be the inspiration for Oedipus Decimus, who was a tavern owner. So they didn't have the same names, except for with John Lovett, his character was named Flanagan because he's Tommy Flanagan on Saturday Night Live. But that was a lot of fun. Because people who, again, had seen the comedy shows, and there weren't many in the game, already knew what the character was all about, and would they warn the newbies or would they not? And a lot of times they would.
Yep. More fun that way.
Yeah, Tommy Flanagan was a guide, so he was not a very reliable guide. So anything he gave was disinformation, so they made a lot of wrong conclusions.
As for me, I for that first game, for that first campaign, I had the benefit of the setting I chose was one of the existing Pokemon settings from the video games. So a lot of it was just kind of making NPC versions of the NPCs from the actual video game. So the big core ones were like the gym leaders, all the people associated with like the Pokemon League that you fight to get stronger and, you know, prove your worth as a trainer. So that was easy because I had like personality basis in the games already to kind of go with from that, just like with the characters from Saturday Night Live, there was a template. And then, you know, from there, after you get your training wheels, so to speak, that's when you start realizing, well, like, okay, well, I need a character who doesn't exist, you know? So that's what I'm going to start trying to spin my wheels. And sometimes I approach it from what am I trying to do? Sometimes I approach it from what would be fun to interact with as a player, you know, like depending on like where they tend to be as far as plot and story stuff. There's a lot of different ways you can approach when you make them and find that inspiration. You can say, okay, well, if I just want something fun, I'm going to look at, like you said, like maybe comedians. I'm going to look at maybe characters in books that I think are funny or characters in film that I think are funny, you know, and like take bits and pieces from there. But if it's something a bit more utilitarian, it'll, you know, be a bit more bare bones and straightforward. Or you could say, I really need someone to maybe galvanize them to do this one quest or, you know, to do X, Y, and Z, and you can kind of then build backwards, so to speak, from like, this is the desired goal, or this is the thing that the NPC is attached to, what kind of person would be attached to it, and then like work backwards that way.
Yeah, you put a lot more thought into it than I put into it. I just go into it with what would be an interesting or amusing personality to have here. Or a character, and sometimes if I'm not familiar with the character, I just invent qualities for the character, and again, some of them become legendary. Like I had a figure for Hawkman from DC. Now, admittedly, I know who Hawkman is, and I remember a couple of the stories about Hawkman, not very much though. So I seem to remember one of the cartoons. You know, he had like a hawk cry that he did. And so I made like a basic, you know, like superhero from the cartoons. And I had him say, I am Hawkman. I played him like totally over the top. And, you know, it was in the astral space that Wizards of the Coast has with their Spelljammer.
Yeah, yeah.
I altered that world, that universe very heavily because I was coming out of it from the Greek mythology. So it had a lot of the things in there that were, you know, very Greek or Olympian. So Hawkman did that a couple of times. Then he wound up being the sheriff on this station that they had discovered. So he became a part of the game while they were there. So every time I'd like to pull my head back and I was saying, I am Hawkman, the kids started saying, I am Hawkman. It became a thing in the game, and it brought a smile to everybody's face when Hawkman, you know, would appear. And then I put Gungans in the game. So we had the Gungans, and all of them sounded like Jar Jar Binks. So that was fun, and they came to look forward to that. So again, the game eventually became like a space comedy, like a lot of the movies that are set in space now with the superheroes. They become very comedic. They enjoyed that for the weeks that I ran it, for the months actually that I ran it. They enjoyed it. It was very different, and they laughed a lot. So that's always a good thing.
And as I've mentioned to Tim, that it's always fun seeing which NPCs the players end up, kind of giving that status to, because it's almost never the ones that you expect them to.
Right. Yeah, Hawkman was a cliche, you know. I just put it in there on a whim because I found the figure, and I figured, hey, wouldn't it be cool, since I'm encountering Star Trek and Star Wars and other science fiction franchise villains and heroes, you know, during the course of their adventures, because the astral, according to metaphysics, is the imaginal, where stories come from, where dreams come from. So I figured that anything that was created by the imagination to inhabit the spaces, the imaginal spaces, was game for inclusion. You never know. And you never know which villain would become villainous. I've had some throwaway villains that became true menaces in the course of some of my campaigns.
Yeah.
I remember with my Star Trek campaign way back in the day. Do you remember the show ALF? Have you heard of the show ALF?
Yeah. I don't think I ever watched it, but I remember who he is and what he looks like.
Well, he was a Melmacian, and so the greatest villain of that whole Star Trek campaign was started out as a one shot, just like your game, was a Melmacian named Tuck, and he was he would pick up aliens from all over the universe. And he made a pirate crew, and he had advanced technology. So it was really hard to get him. Basically they finally blew him up. It took months to get him, and there was much rejoicing, and they were so overjoyed. They encountered him again later on, though, as the Herald of the Galactus. So now he was silver and had steel, a surfboard. So it started again, but who would have known? That was just a goof, and he became their nemesis, and they really hated him and wanted to destroy him.
It didn't happen to me, but I read a story where the DM, kind of in a similar situation, they had their typical this is the big bandit lord, or this is the evil king, and this kind of stuff. But the villain that their party ended up hating the most was this guy who was just named Tom the Slippery. And he was just really good at escaping. And so they could never catch him, and he never did anything crazy. He would just cause mischief, really low level stuff compared to oh my God, we need to fight the Lich. But every time they would confront him, he would slip away because he was just really good at getting away from things. And they hated him. They devoted 6 months to trying to make a trap to catch him. just because they couldn't get that nail in the coffin. And that's why it became so big.
Yeah, they take a life of their own. Oedipus Decimus too, who initially started as a classy Freddie Glassy clone. He actually developed, because that tavern was used very frequently by the characters, and it became a springboard for adventures. So the character evolved and became always he became almost a gruff father figure to them over time. you know, who was old-fashioned and cringeworthy very many times, was still, he had his own, like, special wisdom, and that wasn't anticipated from the beginning. That, like, happened over the course of time. So it's amazing how some of the characters developed, too. Now, where do you draw characters from today in your most recent game? Do you have a particular place that generates character ideas, or?
So a lot of it was during the general world building process, because as you're building up locations and the bare bones of the world, you know, like, there's obviously got to be people associated with those things. So a lot of it came from that. But as we've continued play and like started play and new players have been added, new backstories have been brought into the mix, you know, I've been trying to pull things to relate to those. So, for example, one of my players, his like kind of core conceit, his like driving tenet of his character, is that his father and uncle believe that they were descended from this ancient warlord hero, like depending on how you look at it, who had the same last name as them and wielded some kind of like magic sentient sword. And so his father, who was a bandit, started spreading rumors that he had the sword, which then eventually led to another group of bandits attacking him to steal the sword that he didn't have. And he got killed in the process. And then like the character was raised by the uncle. And so, you know, with that, I wanted to make something of it. I didn't want it to just be a kind of a one and done. I didn't want it to be like a tacked on bit, you know, so I wanted to kind of integrate it into the world. So again, from that perspective of what do I need to achieve this? You know, I kind of worked backwards from that point. And that lich, the type thing that I told you about, who had the mm-hmm. sword made of gems that they just took out. So shortly after they defeated him, they were asking some of the other NPCs, like, who might know some things, more lore about him and stuff like that. And that's when I had the opportunity to drop that the way he originally got sealed away into this tomb where he just got out of was that in the, you know, the elder days, like back before recorded history kind of thing, there were 8 sword thanes who themselves each had a magic blade. And they weren't like allies. They were not on the same side. They were very much just kind of self-serving, like, I'm going to use my powers and my sword for whatever benefits me kind of thing. But when they mm-hmm. saw how powerful he was growing, they united and they managed to, they couldn't kill him, but they managed to banish him into this, you know, tomb, hoping that it would never be opened. And then, so like during the, I dropped that process and dropped a little bit of lore that, you know, they, no one knows where they got the information on how to make the swords. And, you know, but wherever they got that information, they must have gotten the spell they used to banish him from there as well, because no one knows how to do that. But the spell drove them all into a berserker rage. So then the only way to like snap out of it was to kill someone else. So in the end of it, only 3 of them survived banishing him. 5 of them got killed. Their blades were shattered. And then the other 3 kind of came back to their senses and like went their separate ways. And so using that as kind of like the folklore backdrop, I started again, building out from there. So I associated each of the bloodlines with a different type. There's, you know, several different types in Pokemon. So I picked 8 of them that I thought would be interesting to play with having like a weapon associated with. So like there's the go-tos of like, oh, it's dragon, which is considered kind of like the, like, quote unquote, most powerful type. So of course there's going to be one of them associated with that, you know, but on the same mm-hmm. turn, like here's one associated with fairy, which is a very, it's the newest type that they added, and it's, again, like, the associations you get are kind of like light and purity and stuff like that, and so I, you know, picked the types and then wanted to do things with them and then built the characters around that. So the fairy one, again, I didn't want to do, like, the stereotypical thing. So I started with the powers of the blade, because the 5 broken blades, I decided, have been kind of reforged. So they're not as powerful as the 3 blades that remained whole, but they do still have some powers that can be activated by people of that bloodline. So the fairy one is reforged into a small dagger, and pretty much it only gives you 2 main boons, You can temporarily generate like pink wings of light and fly for like 30 minutes. But also when you're wielding it, you appear unarmed and appear trustworthy or weak to other people, depending on which one will benefit you more. So the idea is that the character who has this is a very conniving person who will do what they can to, you know, reach whatever ambitions they have set. And so I liked the idea of having this like sweet, pure and light kind of type associated with a character who's very underhanded and very unafraid to be cutthroat. And so, you know, they kind of merge together, like creating the powers kind of helps shape the character, which then kind of helps shape the powers back and forth. So I just recently made those, and they just got the first little tidbits of information about all that stuff in their last session, because there's one of them who tried to like run away from their association to the ancient bloodlines and the swords and stuff, and they met that person who's very hidden away and like unconnected from the whole thing, and kind of gave them some advice and you know, pointed out like, oh, like whatever you've heard in the histories, you know, like these things are not tools of good, you know. So now he's kind of rethinking. Initially he wanted to find it and you know, like carry it around, because again, like he was raised on these stories of the ancient ancestor being this heroic dragon slayer, and you know, now he's hearing this opinion from this person, but not all of the current ones have that opinion. And it's, you know, the end result is obviously it's one of those things where no tool is inherently good or evil. It's how you use them. But, you know, people are shaped by their interactions with those tools. So, you know, naturally they're going to lean one way or the other.
Wow, that is quite elaborate. Have you ever used like go ahead.
No, you go.
Have you ever, like, when the Pokemon game that you created, it was inspired by a video game. Did you use a strategy guide to help you develop places for them to visit? I found that in my earlier days of dungeon mastering, and even now, if I'm incorporating a particular story into it, even if I don't touch upon the story a lot, some of the places are interesting. So I look for strategy guides if it's a computer game or a video game. And sometimes they have tons of interesting things already developed that just need some minor modification to fit into what I'm doing. But I always found those invaluable resources. And they're usually cheaper than getting gaming guides.
Yeah. I did when I did the first campaign, because that one was based directly off of one of the countries that the games was set in. I got the strategy guide for it had like recently remade the game with like better graphics, a new system, all that kind of stuff. And so I got the strategy guide for that and used that as a jumping off point, kind of like what you just said, to like say, okay, here's an interesting location, or here's like, oh, what things might live on this specific area of the map. I don't need to just make it up, because here's the list of what actually lives there in the game, you know? So that was very, very helpful for the first time, like having that as a go-to and having that to, you know, kind of like measure yourself against in a way.
Uh-huh.
Definitely recommend.
And you seem to be gravitating towards creating your own worlds now.
Yeah. That's, I've never run something that I didn't write from scratch, even if it was based off of a different universe. And so eventually that got to the point where I was like, you know what, I'm already changing these existing universes so much, let me just make my own.
Yeah, I've been doing that a lot lately too. Like, even though it's based on mythic Greece or the astral plane as the ancients might have understood it, and you know, supplemented by some really good gaming products that have been created more recently, I'm finding that I'm getting a lot more enjoyment from the things that I design rather than immersing myself into something that somebody else designed. Back when I was doing Conan and Fangor and Call of Atlantis and Thieves World and Star Trek and the Stargate, we had a role-playing game. When I was doing those, and I was very much into replicating the world as much as possible as it is in the source material, Now it's like I realized I was trying to tell a story through all of these. So why not just focus on the story I'm trying to tell? And I can use elements from these or characters from these in what I'm doing. But why even be concerned with the mechanics of Stargates or with the warp engines of Federation vessels or things like that? They're fetters on my imagination rather than inspiration. Did you find that you're trying to tell a greater story through all of your dungeon mastering creative efforts?
So with this current world, I do have, so the way that I've tried to approach this world is that I really didn't want to fork anything. I didn't want to railroad in any way that I could avoid. So I built as much of the country as I could as a sandbox. But what I did was I kind of bookended that. So there's, I think I mentioned this on a previous episode, there's like six arcs is the idea. And each one of those arcs kind of has like a trigger point and an end point. But everything besides that is open. And so like this whole first half that they've been going through has been them traveling, meeting people, getting the personalities of towns, like getting attached to things. And then once they have organic reasons to then kind of follow what my overarching story is, you know, it'll make more sense than me having forced them to do it.
Right.
I'm trying to avoid too many details just because Jamie is in the other room and she is a player. So I don't want to say too much of the specific details. But the core idea is about a country trying to discover who it is in the face of the world changing around it. And the player is going to have a big influence on which way that lands, how that goes. Things have already been building to, they've begun to see that there are tensions growing between the two main religions in the country and people who are accepting these new changes from other countries and people who want to stick to the old ways. And so that kind of ramp has begun, and eventually that will lead, you know, where it always does, and conflict will come about, and it will be up to the players if they join a side in the conflict, if they try to stop the conflict, you know, if they just try to remove themselves entirely, perhaps find an area to, like, withdraw to and just keep safe from all the fighting. Beyond that, the only other thing I can really say at the moment is that it's a lot about what stories mean, which is a big theme that I think I've mentioned before. I have very strong personal feelings on stories and what they can mean and what they can do. And so the overarching plot and like the big final boss and everything and like all of their machinations that have been going on and will continue going on very closely tie into the idea of what a story means.
I know you've talked about it before, but can you expand on it now for folks who didn't tune on when you talked about it? Because it's a fascinating concept.
In actual Pokemon lore, and this is the part that's hard to believe is real, they had in a recent game revealed that there was a country that had an ancient super weapon that was effectively their version of like a nuke or a railgun from space. It would shoot up energy into the atmosphere that would then curve around the planet and just blow up wherever they were targeting. So that already exists in the Pokemon world. Additionally, in a different country, there is a Pokemon that is effectively a nuclear bomb. So I kind of married those two ideas, and the country where the nuclear bomb Pokemon comes from began to try to expand and take over other areas. They got into war with the country with the super weapon. The super weapon dealt incredible damage to the one with the nuclear bomb. So they were out. They knew that they couldn't win, but they decided to kind of get that last stab into the mix. So they sent in a covert group to sneak in the nuclear Pokemon and detonate it at the super weapon. So when that happened, it caused an immense, terrible explosion. completely obliterated the country that had the super weapon built into it. And my country was the country that bordered that one to the north. And so previously it was connected to this big landmass. But then once that country was destroyed, this one, Vanikrom, became untethered and started to slowly drift into the Arctic Circle. And as a result of the incredible energies of the explosion, it wiped out the like tech levels. It, you know, it was basically a giant EMP wave, kind of set them back hundreds and hundreds of years as far as technology and stuff like that goes. And so they've been relatively isolated since then, and they've been slowly building themselves back up from essentially the Dark Ages. They got blown back, you know. So over the times that they've been doing that, like, you know, this is where the Nordic inspirations came from, and they worshipped the Norse gods. They had a very traditional Nordic-style upbringing, and no one really knew the country existed because it was, again, everyone thought it just got destroyed with the other country in the explosion because it wasn't where it used to be. And so in the campaign's lore, I believe it was about 20 or 30 years ago when the first like emissaries from other countries rediscovered Vanikrom and realized that it was here the whole time. And so now they began opening like trade channels and trying to, you know, give and take, like what can we bring to these people? What can they give to us? That kind of thing. And so as a result, the country is slowly being modernized. And with that modernization, as always, comes forsaking of the traditional values, comes losing the things that brought you to this point. And part of that is, as has been reflected many, many times in real life history, the changing of the core religion of the area. You know, like if you look at Christianity, how many things they adopted from other cultures to help spread their religion to become the dominant one in the area. And so that's kind of what's been happening now is now there's a lot of people who still adhere to the old ways, but now there's these people who believe in these new gods and think that the old ways are useless. I mean, look, now we have modern medicine. Now we have like roads. We have clean water whenever we want it. Like industry is better, you know, all sorts of stuff. There's so many boons that they're getting from the modernization that they're tossing aside their history. And it's mostly about that. It's about where you find the line between that, or do you find the line between that? And do you just decide to stick to one of those two paths, or do you try to marry them as an idea?
Wow. Again, lots of deep thoughts. And do you find that plot lines from years ago recur in your games?
I have recurring characters and like quests associated with them that I'll kind of do that with. So like there's always a farmer Greg or some version of Greg, like Grigori or something like that. And he's always like, he's not, again, very little like black and white, very little evil good. He's shades of Greg, but he's a greedy businessman kind of dude who runs the farm. And so there's always a farmer Greg who's a greedy businessman who runs the farm. And like, it'll usually be that there's a quest where he asks somebody for help. And then they kind of discover that there's a bit of shady stuff going on. And like, what do they decide to do with that? Do they be like, oh, okay, well maybe we could like blackmail him to get some money, or, you know, maybe we work for him, maybe we take him down, that kind of thing. So I have a few echoes like that, that they're kind of just Easter eggs for me. Because most of the other players, like, they don't know that that already happened. So it's just a little thing for me to sit there and smile at.
Yeah, I do the same thing. I have things recur every now and then. Like, back in Pennsylvania, before we moved from Pennsylvania, I was wrapping up some space campaigns. And the last two campaigns were called Die, Gungan, Die, and Wookiee Holocaust. so they wrapped up in Pennsylvania. Then 5 or 6 years later, I'd been running games in northwestern New Jersey. And when we moved to northeastern New Jersey, I wanted to do every world builder does, or universe builder. You have so much material, you got to get rid of a lot of it, you know, and make your stories more streamlined. So I had the Time War, which was like the Crisis of Infinite Earths. You know, you had Time Wars playing out.
Yeah, yeah.
And, I brought the Gungans back, and I brought the Wookiees back, and I got rid of a lot of characters. But then you discover, like every comic book company that's done this discovers that sometimes those characters you got rid of are needed. So you have to undo your undoing of the universe and kind of like incorporate them back into the story again. But yeah, I have a never-ending voyage of the Argo. And since there were 50 Argonauts and no lists agree on who the 50 were, you know, and RPG groups are less than 10. So it's pretty easy to fill in incidents that didn't happen or to approach the situation from a different way. And and like you, I smile because I know who everyone is. And no one else knows who they are, what they've done, or what they symbolize, or what they mean. But yeah, it's a lot of fun to drag those things out and have them become elements again, living elements.
So I have a quest that'll occur later once people are like higher level. But there's a couple Pokemon associated with like time travel.
Mm-hmm.
Going hand in hand with that, someone is going to try to use that, and they're going to bring back all the like the evil teams from the video games that you know were like hundreds of years ago. So they're going to like kind of bring them to this time, and so everybody's going to be like, "Oh my God, it's that guy!" You know, like,
sounds like a lot of fun.
It should be. I don't know when that one will fire off because I think they have to be significantly higher level, but it should be fun, whatever it does.
I dug out some old games, and again, just for inspiration, like the Immortal set from the Dungeons & Dragons from long ago. And I have like the Planescape games, and I have some other games set like in an alternate universe where all the different pantheons of gods were building something. And I like what they did in Thor, Love and Thunder. And I believe somebody told me that in the new Shazam movie, too, they had like a place where gods live. So I've been playing with that idea for quite a while, and I started introducing it in some of my games lately. So I don't know where that'll go, but I feel compelled to tell that story. So it will play itself out in some way.
And I wrote up some tips after we discussed this with the topic. If would that be okay if I went over those as far as like tips for new DMs and stuff like that?
Yeah, that'd be great.
So I broke it down into general and detailed tips, and then there's just some examples. But so like this is my point of view. Obviously, your mileage may vary. You can always do things a different way. There is no one tried and true method, as both Hercules and I can attest. Like there are an infinite number of roads to get where you need to go. But these are just the way signs on the roads that I tend to take. So as far as general NPCs, I always recommend before a session or before a campaign, whenever, make a list of names that would occur in your country so that you have that as a sheet of paper in your notes. And if they suddenly take an interest in, maybe there's a guy running like a stand at the farmer's market. You don't have to sit there and be like, he's Dave, you know, like you have a list of names that will fit and are lore appropriate. So you can just kind of like turn the page and be like, oh, he's so-and-so or she's so-and-so. I also find it helps to have a general idea of the average person in each town, because obviously they're not going to be interacting with every single NPC in a location. So what would the average citizen be like? What's their level of education? What's like, are they friendly to outsiders? That kind of thing. Then I mentioned earlier there's very, very rarely black and white. So it's very important, I think, to try and portray the NPCs as realistic as you can. And going hand in hand with that is that they're going to look at things in shades of gray. Not everyone in your party fights is going to be evil. Some of them are just going to be people who need money and got paid to rob people. You know, like there's always a motivating factor. There's always that potential or diplomacy or, you know, reconciliation of some capacity. I know a big thing I've heard from a lot of people who haven't DM'd is that they're worried about having to do a different voice for every single character. And I think that that's something that can be very intimidating for someone starting out, especially people who have modern times gotten attracted to the hobby by watching things like Critical Role, where you have these voice actors who are professional people, and they have these amazing ranges and all these different voices they can bust out. And that can be very intimidating and almost humbling in a way, make you feel like you're not going to be good enough at it. But I think it's important to understand that you don't need to do that for every single character, especially minor characters. And then I'm sure that, you know, you can back me up on this. How many people have you met in your life that have similar voices? It's not outside the possibility right. of reason to say, oh, okay, you know, the minor NPCs, I don't need to do a voice, you know. But then going hand in hand with that, the last general NPC tip is I like voices myself, but something I lean towards more, especially for off-the-cuff characters that I maybe didn't have planned, is playing with the manner of speech. And I think that's something that's underused but can be just as effective as doing a voice. So, for example, maybe modifying the speed that an NPC talks at, the way that they inflect their words, if they perhaps use or don't use specific words or repeat certain phrases, that kind of thing. I had a Blue Jay NPC in a game where everybody was rabbits. It's very Watership Down.
yes, I love
and so
that.
So they were trying to have the Blue Jay like find where they could make a nest. And they were trying to, like, you know, pay him, quote unquote, to do it. And so he loved acorns. And like when I set out, I was like, okay, his weird thing is he cannot count past one. And so they would have these discussions where he'd be like, I'll do it for 1-1 acorn, you know, stuff like that. So just having like something like that, just a little thing of the speech being a bit unique, that can be just as effective as putting on a voice, doing a whole production, so to speak. As far as like detailed / important NPCs, if you think that the NPC is going to be important before you introduce them, and if you think they're going to recur in multiple sessions, definitely try to give them a name ahead of time so that, you know, you can kind of build more for them. Give them a physical description. And one of my kind of guidelines is try to give them at least one feature that stands out in some way. Maybe it's that they have a different hair color than most people in the region. Maybe they wear their hair a different way. Maybe they wear something odd or carry an interesting weapon. They could have an animal companion you've never seen before. Something like that. Just something to get them to like stick out just that little bit. I always recommend, and this is something that I really started doing more and more the past like 5-6 years, I try to give every one of my recurring NPCs at least one hobby or interest that's something they could be engaged in when they are, quote unquote, not on screen. So something to kind of give them that little, just extra little bit of personality, make them feel a bit more three-dimensional. So it's not like, oh, this person only exists when I need them. You know, like, oh, yes, sorry, I couldn't answer your call. I was weaving, you know, like I weave as a hobby, that kind of thing. I like to assign between 1 to 3 adjectives to any recurring NPCs to kind of just give me a guideline of how to speak to that character's voice. Sometimes they'll be positive, sometimes they'll be negative, sometimes they'll be both. And then last tip for that would be if after like kind of building out the rest of the character, if you think that they're going to be a recurring character, try to give them a goal that they personally want to accomplish over the course of however long in the game. It could be something small. It could be, I would like to raise enough money to, you know, save my father's farm. Or it could be something big, like I want to become a world-renowned historian, you know. But if you give them something to work towards, it goes in hand with that hobbies, the things they do off screen. This is something that you can have them doing or working towards in the background to make them meeting the party a bit more organic, make them requesting help or not being able to help more organic, you know, just to avoid them being, again, just like a summoned beck and call kind of thing and give them that extra depth.
Those are good. Those are good suggestions. You have more? I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry. I have a couple examples, but I think I've been talking for quite some time. So, what would your suggestions and tips be for people who haven't DM'd before? What would be like your main guiding tips for making NPCs for a first timer?
Basically, I would ask myself the question, like, what NPCs do I need to keep the story or the information flowing? So what type of information can they get from where? What is the information? Is it accurate or isn't it accurate? So I try to give the NPCs a purpose in the game. But if mm-hmm. it seems like they're not going to interact with that NPC, I'll quickly create another or have another one, you know, give them the information or interact with them or lead them to a realization. So just basically, how can the NPCs convey information to your players of various quality? And sometimes erroneous information, too, because mm-hmm. that's very interesting as they try to put together a puzzle where the pieces don't actually belong together. Also, what motivates the NPCs to do what they're doing? Like, why are they adventuring? Why are they selling vegetables in the market square? You know, why are they traveling from point A to point B? You know, what motivates them? And it doesn't have to be a motivation that makes sense to you or even resonates with you. And sometimes these idiosyncrasies that you give them are the key to making them popular. Because some of these idiosyncrasies resound and resonate with people, and then the NPC becomes more real to them. And if something happens to the NPC also that's more impactful than if it's just three villagers were killed, you know, including one guy you bought a watermelon from in the bazaar. You know, that doesn't really leave But if the watermelon seller was someone with a personality that they interacted with, that they argued over the price of the watermelon with or whatever, it touches them emotionally if something happens to that watermelon seller. And also pretty much reminding the players through the NPCs that there are law and order folks, you know, whether they be soldiers or whether they be policemen or whether they be city guard or, you know, whatever they are. So they can't like be murder hobos without consequence. Because that happens a lot in games, especially with newbies. It's like murder people or murder animals or murder monsters and take their stuff and then steal cool stuff that other people have as quickly as possible. So I try to break that as quickly as possible by showing that there is consequence.
Yeah, I think it's definitely the softer touch to use as guidelines, is having the NPCs rather than just like flat out telling them, oh, no, you can't do that or you shouldn't do that. I think it's better to have the NPCs react to the things they do, and that kind of informs them of, oh, you know, maybe I shouldn't do this because I might get the wrong attention, you know.
I did that not too long ago. They'd done something. I don't remember what it was, but it was pretty atrocious and antisocial. So I had all the people in the spaceport where they were react to how monstrous that was, and, you know, that, you know, or running away and, like, pointing to them in hushed whispers and people looking mortified. And that kind of, they weren't expecting that, and they behaved a lot better after that.
Yeah, it's everyone always sees themselves as the hero. And then so realizing that something you did may not have been heroic, may not have been agreed as the best option, that can be very sobering.
And also I find that meeting NPCs like in places other than when you first knew them, if they're traveling to another village on their quest for, you know, whatever they're questing for, they see an NPC who happens to have a relative that lives in that town, and, you know, so things like that, or like somebody joining the army of that they're against or for in part of the campaign, you know, realizing that one of the enemies was somebody that they knew, a kid that they watched growing up in one of the previous adventures. So I try to humanize the NPCs as much as possible. And even if I'm making one up on the spot because the situation calls for it and I need it, I try again to infuse something unique and different and endearing about that character, even if it's endearing in a negative way like a Freddie Blassie was. You never know what he's going to evolve into.
Exactly, yeah. All you need is that one thing that helps them feel like they're not just interacting with the same person over and over again, which is hard because really they are. But,
yeah,
you know, that's the love of it, is you putting enough of yourself into it to maintain the facade, maintain the prestige, you know?
Yeah, and that is the fun of it, and that is where the NPCs get a chance to shine and become more than just the words or a little figure on the table. Speaking about figures on the table, do you use maps or is it all theater of the mind?
So with this campaign, I've started using battle maps a bit more. I always had like a world map, so I could kind of say like, here's a marker of like where you guys are in the country or whatever. But given the fairly extensive, you know, there's, I think, 1,008 Pokemon now. And you know, so it's a very, very crunchy system.
Yeah.
So I've realized that battle maps can help a lot with figuring out ranges of moves, with just helping players visualize it, especially some of the players are not familiar with, like, every game. So it helps having even just a small representation on the board of what they might be facing. So I ended up buying, and I really love them. They were a great purchase. I found a seller on Etsy who makes small circular dry erase tokens, a little bit bigger than a quarter. The main intent is to use them for games like Magic to keep track of like counters that might be on a card, as opposed to like using physical tokens and stuff. But they were perfect for what I need because, again, with 1,008 Pokemon plus any human opponents, it's a lot easier if I can just erase and write a new name on something as opposed to having to have 1,008, you know, like, so I got like 10 in each of the different colors because they have like, oh, this one's blue on the outside, this one's purple on the outside, that kind of thing. And they have been a major help. So even something as plain as that, because it's not pictures, it's not standees, it's just a flat disc with either like the player's name or whatever they're fighting. But even that, I think, helps the players.
I think so, too. I use maps. I purchase maps now. It's the same set for, like, different adventures. But I have a lot of sets. And I started looking into map books now. There are some, like, modular map books. And they're expensive. They're kind of pricey, but they're definitely worth it. So I bought one. I'm going to buy another one in, like, a few weeks. And because they have like 60 maps in it, and some of them are one page, some 2 pages, and some, if you have like other books in the series, you could really fill up a whole table with unique maps in different combinations. So I've been looking at those. I was getting mostly science fiction, outer space recently, but now that that's winding down and I'm going back to mythic Greece, I have like dozens of maps that are like countryside and ancient temple-y type of places and deserts and so forth. So I should be okay. And they haven't really come out with anything for that type of setting in quite a while. But I've been gaming since the 70s, so I have quite a collection of like maps and things like that.
And it's something I've found that both I enjoy and my players have enjoyed is I always, like when I do notes and stuff, prep for games, I usually do it on like grid lined paper. Something about it just makes it easier for me to like remember everything and whatever. But that's also really good for making maps. And so what I'll do for a lot of like quote unquote dungeons is I will make the map of the dungeon and I will hand my players a blank sheet of grid paper. And I'll be like, okay, so you're starting like here on this square. And you can fill in all of the squares touching you. You can see what those are. And so you guys will be moving in the space and then like drawing your own map as you slowly figure out like where are the walls, where are the holes, where's this, that, and the other thing. And it can get really fun watching them, especially if they each have their own map and then realize that they're not keeping the same map. And it's like, oh my God, I thought the wall was there. You know, it's like, I did that recently with, they went in the desert, and so I got a like poster board sized grid line paper, and I bought huge packs of Crayola markers of like, this is a box of just yellow, this is a box of brown, you know? And as they explored the desert, they slowly sat there coloring in the poster board, and like they loved it. They thought it was so much fun.
Yeah, I occasionally have drawing things for them to do, or like puzzly type things for them to do, or riddles. Not, I don't let these things dominate the game, because then it becomes like a Monty Hall type of thing. But I have occasionally, like for some kids, I was running like an adventure still in Mythic of Greece. And this gold, this bowl that was on a pillar and was glowing, told them to get, you must give, you know, and things like that. So they had to figure out, you know, that they couldn't just be collecting stuff that's theirs and then defending it. You know, they had to give something up to get what they might need. And it's an instructional dungeon, because these are total newbies. So teaching them the protocols and the customs of non-murder hobo role-playing, you know, is part of the first campaign. And sometimes they like it, sometimes they're not happy with that. They want to, you know, kill things and take their stuff.
It's one of those things where you can never please everybody. Everyone always wanted something different out of the game.
Now, I looked at the clock. We have only like 3 minutes to go. And I'd like for you to share with people how they can find you, how they can interact with you, how can they get involved with the wonderful things you're doing.
So you can find me on Facebook under my name, Zach McAtee, or you can send me an email at mrmunnin@gmail.com.
Awesome. Zach, thank you very much. Always a pleasure speaking with you, and I always learn a lot from our conversations. I wish you very well with your new move and with all your ventures, be they gaming or no.
Yeah, and thank you very much, as always, for having me, for being so kind and welcoming, and again, for I learn a lot from you too. So these are always something I look forward to.
Thanks a lot, and thanks to all our listeners. If you clicked on a link and found yourself here, if you called and you're patiently waiting in our queue, or you're going to check us out later on demand, until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys, amazing adventures, and great gaming. Take care, and thanks again, Zach.
Have a great night.
You too.